This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we're going to talk about difficult people and how to portray difficult people with two experts in the craft, one a writer and the other an actor. Robert Caro is one of a kind, maybe the most obsessive biographer alive. And reading him for the first time, it's a really riveting experience. His biographies cover just two subjects, the great city planner of New York, Robert Moses, and Lyndon Johnson. His work on Moses and LBJ are studies of power and how to use power by two politicians who knew how to bend democracy to their will. Caro's research, it's truly prodigious, is matched by the rivers of his prose, his command of pace and rhythm, mood, and the sense of place. All the things we talk about when we talk about fiction. So it's fitting that when Robert Caro appeared at the New Yorker Festival last fall, he was interviewed by one of the great novelists working today, Ireland's Colm Toibín. Toibín started by asking Caro about his first book from 1974, The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York.
In the building of Robert Moses in this book, it seems to me that you are taking a great deal from the way in which fiction is built without, of course, having to make up any facts. That in other words, you were, in one hand, you had to deal with the facts. But on the second hand, you had to then start working with an interpretation of character arising from those facts and give that character a particular sort of density, which was which explained a great deal, but also left a great deal mysterious. So I'm just wondering, at the beginning, when you were studying, for example, fiction, before you became a biographer, how much that idea of fiction made its way into then what you did, what you began to do as a biographer?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. You know, Robert Moses didn't want this book done. He did everything he could to stop it, and for the first few years, he wouldn't speak to me at all. After about 3 years, I think he figured out that it was going to be done whether he wanted it or not. So he did give me 7 interviews. They were not so much interviews as monologues. Questions were not what interested him. But I would emerge and think, they're such opposite, wholly opposite sides of his character. How does he resolve them within himself, and how do I show them to the reader? For example, there's the idealistic and dreamer thing. I remember once can I tell for a minute what it was like where he sat? So Robert Moses had this cottage, you know, there's Jones Beach, and then if you continue on that parkway eastward, you get first to Gilgo Beach, and then to a little community of modest summer cottages called Oak Beach. I understand it's not quite so modest anymore. So Moses had rented the last house, and what he had done was he tore out 2 walls in that living room and made them picture windows. So out the left picture window, you saw the Robert Moses Causeway going over the front. And out of the right picture window, you saw the tower of Robert Moses State Park. And he sat in the corner in this big leather chair, but two things. One was this idealistic dreamer thing. I mean, he was, whatever year this was, let's say he was approximately 79 or 80 or 81. And he was immensely strong and powerful man. And once he was talking about a road that he was having trouble building, they stopped him from building it, the Fire Island Highway, which would have actually been wider in parts than Fire Island, and beyond the length of Fire Island. And he jumped up like a kid, grabbed my arm. I can still feel his fingers on my arm, and he pulled me out on the deck. And he said, "Can't you see there ought to be a highway there?" And you felt this was a man who was so invested in his dreams, in what he wanted. There was an idealism in it. It was a mistaken idealism. This particular road would have been a terrible mistake, as most of his roads were mistakes. But at the same time, he believed it. And the other side was this incredible, what you could call, in a nice way, pragmatism. He taught me so much about politics. I remember I asked him once about how he had gotten getting the Republican votes to establish Jones Beach, and he said something like, "Well, it was 8-7 against us in the Ways and Means," he said, "but the key vote was Stevens of Cattaraugus County, and Stevens had a mortgage on his house, and the mortgage was held by the Rochester State Bank, and the way to get to the Rochester State Bank was through Sam Smith." And I suddenly realized he was thinking on a level, and teaching me, a level of practical politics that was part of him too, a ruthlessness, a way he was going to get it one way or the other. So it's opposite sides, just as you said.
I met you years ago, and I said to you that you had done more damage to Ireland than Oliver Cromwell. Sorry, nothing. And you said, "I've not done any damage to Ireland," but actually you have, because what happened was when this book came out, and then when the volumes of the Johnson biography came out, Irish politicians began to read them really carefully. I imagine it's not just Ireland. When I was working as a journalist, I would ask somebody something really like that, where someone had known something about someone, gone and done something behind their back, and then found out their mortgage. I'd say, "Where did you think of that?" And they'd say, "Caro." And particularly Charles J. Hawkey, who was the skullduggery-led Prime Minister of Ireland for a very long time. But I think that sense in the book of, if you want to change a city, you really have to understand how it works. And in order to understand how it works, it's personal. And it's down to the smallest detail about people. And this was something that you had to learn, much as he had to learn.
No, I had to learn as much as he had to learn. I mean, it all started, I had been a reporter for Newsday, and I was an investigative reporter, and I got more and more interested in politics. So I had won, believe me, a couple of really minor, I mean really minor journalistic awards, but when you're 24 or 25 years old and you win anything, you think you know everything. So Robert Moses wanted to build this bridge from Rye in Westchester County over to Oyster Bay. And Newsday had assigned me to look into this bridge, and I found out it was really the world's worst idea. Just to take one thing, the Long Island Expressway would have needed 12 additional lanes just to handle the traffic. So they sent me up to Albany, and I saw the governor, Nelson Rockefeller, and he understood it was the worst idea in the world, and I saw his counsel. He understood president of the state senate, and they all understood, and I wrote an article basically saying, "The bridge is dead." And I went back to Long Island. So I had a friend in Albany, and a couple of weeks later, he called me, and he said, "Bob, I think you ought to come back up here." And I said, "Oh, I don't think that's necessary. I think I took care of this." And I remember, and he said, "Well, Robert Moses was up here yesterday, and I think you ought to come back." So I drove up to Albany, and I still remember walking into the press gallery of the assembly as they approved some measure necessary to keep the bridge by a vote of something like 142-4. And I remember in that moment, it was a moment of real awakening for me. It was like, everything you've been writing up to here is bullshit, because everything you write, even if you don't say it directly, underlying it is the belief that we live in a democracy, and in a democracy, power comes from the ballot box and from being elected. And here was a man who was never elected to anything, and he had more power than anyone, any governor or any mayor who was elected, more power than any governor and mayor combined, and he had this power for 44 years. And you, Bob, who's supposed to know about political power, has no idea where he got this power, and neither does anybody else. So that was really the genesis of the power broker, you could say, right there.
There's a particular chapter in this book that really, really makes you sit up. It's a chapter called One Mile. Oh. And when you come to it, you just go, you know, that this idea of building freeways, of recreating a city in your own likeness or according to the plans that you have, actually involves a great deal of destruction. And by a certain year, Moses was not interested in hearing anyone else's opinion. And you start to write in a very serious way about, you know, old people who are living in an area, I'm going to mispronounce it, called East Tremont?
East Tremont, yeah.
East Tremont. And that old people could live in a building and get looked after because they could walk on the streets. Everybody knew each other. Yeah. Little stores could exist beside other little stores. And this was simply to be destroyed. I mean, you have an extraordinary sentence. It happens quite a lot in these books where you do one of those, you know those one sentence paragraphs where you go, the letters came on December the 4th, 1952. You go, oh dear. And the letters, of course, came to say, you're out, all of you.
Yes.
And it looks for a while, because you're building up the story very slowly, that these people are going to actually prevail, that they've set up a group, that they're actually, it makes no sense to put the freeway there, because it could equally just go there. And I think it's an important element in the Moses book, just the idea that you move down from the flawed, heroic figure of Moses into the much more difficult business of ordinary people whose lives were deeply affected by him.
If I want to talk about political power, I got to show what it does to people. So you went over to this neighborhood, and it was this horrible, the expressway was still under construction, so they had the huge cranes. It seemed like a war zone. But in these buildings, in which this night, they had been a nice neighborhood before, now you went into these buildings, and they were this horrible slum. You walked into a lobby, and of course, well, the pipes had been pulled out by the druggies for, you know, the copper. But there were also piles, I remember, I'm squeamish, I couldn't stand it. There were piles of human feces in the corner. Everything smelled of urine. And you'd go up, you knocked on doors. I mean, it had turned into an African-American neighborhood. And you knocked on doors, and very often when you came up to knock on the door, Comb, you heard children's feet running around inside. You knock on the door, and silence. Sometimes, I think I wrote this in the book, sometimes they would open the door, and that was worse than when they wouldn't. But I remember this one woman, which I'll never forget, she's stuck in my mind forever. It was an African-American woman, quite young, I thought, and she had four or five little kids there. And I started to ask her, you know, when did you move in? What was the neighborhood like? She kept, no matter what I asked her, she kept saying the same sentence. I've got to get my kids out of here. I've got to get my kids out of here. Then you said, well, where are the people who used to be here? Well, that was really hard. I mean, with people, the simplest things take so long in these books. How do you find the people who have moved away? Where are they, you know? Then we had telephone books, and I remember Ina and I sitting on the floor in the public library. They used to have a telephone book section with all these telephone books trying to find people. Then you would find them, and you would interview them, and I have a rule that no matter how late it is, my rule is that I always type them up before I go to bed that night, so the expressions on their faces are clearer in my mind. And I remember I was typing the same word over and over in different interviews, and the word was lonely. These people had this community. Now they were stuck in apartments in a housing project in Co-op City, living with their kids in the suburbs, because they couldn't really afford apartments in New York then. And part of the story of Power is the story of what happened to these people. I have to tell it. It was a hard thing. The book was already way too long. You know, nobody was going to publish it. But I felt I had to do that. So at the time I was finding these people was the time Moses was giving me interviews. He stopped. When I started asking him hard questions, the interviews were over forever. So I remember, this was in the weeks when I'm hearing these terrible people whose whole lives had been taken away from them, you know? And then I would drive down to Moses' house in Oak Beach, and I brought up something like, there's a lot of opposition up there. I said, oh, no. So I said, well, there was the East Tremont neighbor. He said, oh, they just stirred up the animals up there. So I said, well, how did you defeat them? He says, I just stood pat, that's all. I would get so angry at him. You know, you're not supposed to do that, and it disrupts your flow of questioning. Sometimes those days, I would really be angry at this man.
That's Robert Caro, author of The Power Broker and The Years of Lyndon Johnson. He spoke at the New Yorker Festival with the novelist Colm Tóibín. They'll continue in a minute on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every year in October, the New Yorker puts on a weekend-long blowout of events all over the city called the New Yorker Festival. And today, we're listening to two conversations from our festival in the fall of 2017. A little later in the show, we'll hear the actress Glenn Close speaking with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman. And right now, we'll continue with Colm Tóibín interviewing Robert Caro. Caro is the author of The Power Broker about the urban planner Robert Moses, and by any assessment, one of the essential books about New York City. And after completing that book about the city where he grew up, Caro began the massive project called The Years of Lyndon Johnson. He's published four volumes and is working on a fifth, following Johnson from his origins as a poor boy in West Texas through his dominance in the U.S. Senate to the presidency of the United States. Here's Robert Caro with Colm Tóibín.
When you had to start with the Lyndon Johnson book in a world of Texan hill country, how did you begin? I mean, how did you start with that material?
Well, I learned what the place was, what it was like to live in such a lonely place. I remember the first time I drove out there there was a town called Dripping Springs, and there was one other little town whose name I forgot. That was all there was. These are towns of a couple of hundred people in the 43 miles between Austin and Johnson City. And so then you talk to these people and you'd say, well, what were the elements in Lyndon Johnson's life? Well, loneliness. So he had a brother, Sam Houston Johnson, his younger brother. So he told me how he and Lyndon used to go down to the corner of the ranch closest to the road and sit on the fence there, hoping that one new person would ride by so they'd have a new person to talk to that day. So you say, here's Lyndon Johnson. He's living in the middle of this. What are his parents like? His mother is a soft, educated person. His father is a domineering, overbearing, huge character, for a long time the most successful man in Johnson City. Then he makes this one mistake. He pays too much for this Johnson Ranch, and he goes completely broke and becomes a laughingstock. And Lyndon Johnson, in talking to other people, has said, you know, when I was campaigning with my father, those were the happiest days of my life. I would drive with him from farm to farm. He'd have a big loaf of bread. We'd have a jar of jelly. We'd stop by the side of the road, the two of us, and talk and have lunch together. Those were the happiest days of my life. Then other people say, after his father lost, Lyndon Johnson's relationship with his father shifted completely. He was, 12 or 13, I guess. He hated, he seemed to hate him. He wouldn't do anything that his father told him, anything. And he set out to humiliate him. He made the townspeople believe he had a drinking problem, the father did, which he didn't. He badmouthed them all his life. His father made this one mistake. He bought the ranch. He went broke. He became the laughing stock of the hill country.
I think there are two things from that then. I mean, of all the things that are complicated, Texas is, as we've just learned, I mean, but the United States Senate, for someone who wasn't born in it, seems the most strange, most obscure, most peculiar institution. And someone coming in whose knowledge is all local, but is also hurt, there's also someone coming in without the confidence of coming in to dominate it from the beginning. Someone is coming in, as you say, the guy who doesn't have enough money, you know, as a certain age. So you combine those two things into this most complex institution, which requires a huge amount of detailed attention. The Texas background becomes an essential ingredient in two different ways as he begins to understand how the Senate works and eventually how he comes to dominate. And I think the big one you do here is the Civil Rights Act of 1957.
Yes.
Or just the amount of cajoling, the amount of knowing people.
Yes.
The amount of, some people you clap them on the back, others you threaten,
yes,
others you make deals with.
Yes. Yes.
But all of that comes from Texas.
Well, I'll tell you how much all of it comes from Texas. You're asking terrific questions. So I just said about the father made the one mistake. What did Lyndon Johnson's aides in the Senate know? Never let him lose a vote. He must never lose a vote because he had learned the cost of one mistake. He's the majority leader of the United States Senate. He wins so, the Republicans actually are in control for some of the years, the Southern Democrats who are against him in some of the years, but he wins every vote. You say, oh my God, that's because he's learned the cost of failing even once. The other part is this genius he has with human beings. I mean, the way he can manipulate them people think Johnson talks all the time. If you listen to these tapes, Cone, he's often doesn't talk at all for the first few minutes. You hear him say, all he has is this sound, and you get the feeling, and then you see what's coming. He's listening for what the guy really wants, what he's really afraid of. And he has a genius in knowing it. You know, it's just a genius. Can I give you one example? So it's not 57, it's 64, okay? So the Southern Democratic strategy is they're not gonna let the civil rights bill come. I'm gonna oversimplify dramatically here. They're not gonna let the civil rights bill come to the floor, and the way they're gonna keep it from coming to the floor is they're gonna keep the tax bill on the floor. The way they're gonna keep the tax bill as a subject of debate is they're not gonna let it out of Harry Burns. He's the senator from Georgia. He's the guy who said, Brown versus Board of Education. He says, little children, six-year-old white girls riding on a bus, what's gonna happen? Miscegenation, marriage. And he's got the vote nine to six against him. We hear on the tapes a senator named George Smathers, who was a very pragmatic senator, and Johnson used him because he could give him accurate reports. He calls Johnson in the White House and he said, it's all over, we've lost. We're three votes short. There's nothing we can do. We've tried everything. There's absolutely nothing that can be done. We'll bring it up again next year. We know this from the tapes. Johnson says, who are the three votes? They say Ribicoff, Anderson, Clinton Anderson of New Mexico, and Frank Lauschi of Indiana. He says, line them up for me. That means have them on the phone line one after the other. So we hear him say to Abe Ribicoff. Ribicoff says, Lyndon, I can't change my vote. I promised my constituents I'd lose face. You have to hear Lyndon Johnson's tone when he says, Abe, you save my face today, I'll save your face tomorrow. And Ribicoff knows Lyndon Johnson is a very bad guy to cross, but he's a very good guy to have on your side. He changes his vote. The next person is Clinton Anderson. Clinton Anderson is a guy who's always, he's been in the Senate as long as Johnson. He came in 48, they were freshmen together. He's always wanted to be a leader. Johnson knows this. He wants more than anything to be minority leader, majority leader, minority whip, you know. He's never gotten a leadership post. Johnson says to him, Clinton, in this committee, you take the leadership on this thing. We need a leader here. He uses the word leader like four times. Clinton Anderson goes along. The next one is Lauschi. Johnson knows that what Lauschi wants out of the tax bill is no excise taxes on musical instruments, because musical instruments factory is a big factory in whatever state I just said that was, Indiana. And he basically says to Lauschi, we can't give it to you this year, we'll give it to you next year. He changes these three votes in whatever I have in the book. I think it's 6 minutes and 31 seconds. It comes out of the tax bill is disposed of, I'm oversimplifying. The civil rights bill gets to the floor and we have the civil rights bill.
Yeah, so it's another interesting example of that idea of Johnson as having many characteristics, that there are many things available to Johnson at every moment. So we come then to the small matter of Bobby Kennedy. And I just wondering if you could give us the beginning of this as how you see these two figures. I mean, it's a feud, it's not a petty feud. And it's not just a feud between two guys, a tall guy or a small guy. It's not just a North-South feud. It's not just a Catholic, you know, Protestant feud, which I know about. But it is actually something magisterial about the feud. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Yes. You know, I call it a blood feud. I call it the greatest blood feud in American politics. And the amazing thing to me, the lucky thing to me, lucky, just luck, is I know how exactly the first time they met. I was interviewing all Johnson's aides. Two of his longtime aides were named George Reedy and Horace Busby, and they saw it. So if they hadn't both seen it, and they hadn't both used the same words to describe it to me, I wouldn't have used it. So can I tell this?
Yes, sure, of course.
So in those days, it was the height of the McCarthy era. I think it's 1953 or 54. Johnson is the great majority leader of the Senate. And he has breakfast every morning in the Senate cafeteria. And in the Senate cafeteria, there's a big round table then by the cash register, and Senator Joe McCarthy sits at it every morning with his staffers. And Johnson walks in one morning. Now, Bobby Kennedy is whatever he is. He's a kid. He's 25 or 26 years old. They have never met, Lyndon Johnson and Bobby Kennedy. And Joe McCarthy and his staff jump up and do what everyone always does when Lyndon Johnson comes into the, oh, good morning, Mr. Leader. You were great yesterday, Mr. Leader. You pulled that victory out of the hat, Mr. Leader. We wouldn't have won without you, Mr. Leader. Except for one person. One person sits at that table and does not get up. Johnson looks around and he sees it's Bobby Kennedy. And Johnson knows what to do in any interpersonal order. He sort of walks around the table with his hand like this. So Bobby Kennedy is actually going to be forced either to snub him or to stand. And Bobby Kennedy has to stand up. So I said to Reedy and Busby, so they both said, we asked them, what was that about? So Johnson says something, which is certainly part of it, that Johnson had been telling discourteous stories about Bobby Kennedy's father. Here were two men who hated each other from the first moment they saw each other. And of course, this hatred, as you know from the last volume, goes on amazingly when Jack Kennedy offers Lyndon Johnson the vice presidency. We have these incredible scenes when Jack Kennedy is taking a nap and Robert Kennedy comes down the back stairs of the hotel in Los Angeles three times to try to get Lyndon Johnson to withdraw from the ticket. Lyndon Johnson was later to describe those as the worst moments of his life. He was never to forgive Bobby Kennedy for it. When he's vice president and Robert Kennedy is the president's brother, has the power over him, he makes sure Johnson's not allowed to have a plane unless Bobby Kennedy signs off. Johnson's not allowed to make a speech unless Bobby Kennedy signs off on it. He humiliates him in every way possible. The big thing in Washington then is to be invited to these parties at Hickory Hill, Bobby Kennedy's home. Lyndon Johnson isn't usually invited. When he is, he's put at what Ethel Kennedy calls the loser's table. And he knows it's the loser's table. And then in an instant, in the crack of a gunshot in Dallas, the tables are completely turned. The man, now he has the power. And the scene, I must say, I've never been quite happy with the way I wrote it, where he calls Bobby Kennedy from the plane, when before it's taken off from Dallas, to ask him the most hurtful question he could think of to ask him. What's the exact words I use when I take the oath? He doesn't have to say, to take your brother's job. That's one of the incredible telephone calls that was ever made. I mean, it's a call from a man who has a genius in hurting to a man who's just been hurt. Anyone could have told Lyndon Johnson the words of that oath. It's in the Constitution. That's an example of the hatred between them and the way the tables were turned.
And we're coming to the end. What you have to do now in this scene where you have Johnson, who's been building up to this. I mean, there's an extraordinary moment in 56 where he's the most unlikely candidate for president. I mean, it just shows you how you can never tell what's coming next, because someone in 56 who was really at the, I mean, his heart attack and nobody wanted him, et cetera. So, but here he is in Dallas that day, where he suddenly realizes now what's coming his way. He's going to be president of the United States. That he's been humiliated in every way. He's not let into the Oval Office. As you say, he's not let into the parties. Suddenly it's coming. Now, you as a biographer have a decision to make as to what you're going to do now with this. And that section, which I presume everyone here has read, where you get him, and you obviously get enough sources of information to describe silence, where he's alone in the room, where enough people are watching him to know, leave him. He's working his way through this.
That one was really hard to write. You know, for those of you who haven't read it, then the test is Tuesday. Nobody tells Johnson how Jack Kennedy is. He's standing in this room in Dallas in front of a cinder block wall. He's not moving. And the amazing thing is they all said this. In there was Lady Bird with him, the Secret Service agent, a guy named Rufus Youngblood, and a Texas congressman named Homer Thornberry. And they all used the same words. He never moved. His face changed. He seemed different somehow. Lady Bird says, I looked up at my husband and his face was like the face of a graven bronze idol. Whatever he's thinking, we don't know. But when at the end of the half hour, someone comes in and Lady Bird says, seeing Kenny O'Donnell, who loved Jack Kennedy, come through the door, we knew. Then a moment later, another Kennedy aide comes in and comes over to Johnson's and says, Mr. President. That's the first he knows that he's president. And as soon as that happens, he starts giving orders. It's like he's been planning these orders during this half hour. They say, we should get out of Dallas right away. Get on the plane. The safest place for you is on the plane, and the safest place is in Washington. They don't know if it's a conspiracy. He says, no, I'm not leaving without Mrs. Kennedy. They said, well, Mrs. Kennedy won't leave her husband's body. He says, then we'll go to the plane and wait for Mrs. Kennedy, but I won't leave Dallas without him. The police say, we'll take you in a caravan this way. He says, take a different route and make sure there are no sirens. Everything is planned out.
That he wants Mrs. Kennedy in the photograph when he's being sworn in,
yes.
In case anybody thinks there's been a coup of some sort. But what you have to do is it a page? Is it two pages? Actually give us a sense of this man who realizing that all his ambitions are now going to come his way, but you don't know what he's thinking. And you don't tell us what he's thinking because you don't know.
Yes.
But nonetheless, you give us a sense of what it must have been like or might have been like. I think it's one of those really great moments in modern biography, or indeed in modern writing, yes. Where without having to bend the facts or make anything up.
Yes.
So could you tell us about writing that, or how many times you wrote it, or did you write longhand? Or
well, I write in longhand, as you know. I do a lot of writing, a lot of drafts in longhand. Then I use a typewriter, as I think you use a typewriter. I wrote that scene so many times. I wish I had counted it, you know. If you look at the picture that you know of Lyndon Johnson taking the oath of office and Jackie Kennedy standing next to him, there are 26 people in that room. I said, I'm not going to write this book until I interview every one of those 26 who's not dead. I'm writing this scene. And I suddenly realize I have forgotten one person in the photograph, the photographer. I called his office. His name is Cecil Stoudt. I said, Mrs. Stoudt, I'm sorry. She says, oh, Mr. Caro, that's all right. Cecil has been waiting for you to call.
Robert Caro, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the best interview I ever had.
Historian Robert Caro, author of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, speaking with novelist Colm Toybean. In a moment, Glenn Close will talk about playing some of the cinema's scariest women, from Fatal Attraction's Alex Forrest to Cruella de Vil. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me on the New Yorker Radio Hour. American theater and film don't have too many people you could legitimately describe at any given moment as a master. Meryl Streep and a few others, it's a pretty short list, but certainly near the top of the list is Glenn Close. Last year, Close was on Broadway playing Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard. And like Desmond, many of Glenn Close's characters could be described as difficult, sometimes scary, maybe a little crazy, but above all, just complicated. And since 1974, when she made her debut on Broadway, she's won 3 Tonys, 3 Emmys, and been nominated 6 times for an Oscar. At the New Yorker Festival in 2017, Glenn Close spoke with the New Yorker's Michael Shulman, who covers theater for the magazine.
So you said what actually saved me more than anything else was my desire to be an actress. So let's talk about that. You attended the College of William and Mary and studied acting there, and then moved to New York in the early 70s. There was this amazing story of kind of this showbiz myth of the young understudy going on for the lead and then launching her stardom from there. Is that sort of how that actually happened in
well,
that
it wasn't 42nd Street.
It sounds a lot like it.
It was a Congreve.
People don't know it.
You know, it's a Congreve restoration comedy. but I was understudying a beautiful actress, Mary Yor, and I was given a little part in each production, but I was understudying the leads. And I was so green and hungry. And I would go to every rehearsal and sit in the back, and I would just observe. I would observe. And for some reason, I learned the lines during those weeks of rehearsal. And we went out to Philadelphia, and Mary was having problems remembering her lines and other things. And so we came back to New York. We're at the old Helen Hayes Theater that doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. I walked in, and there was Hal, and he said, "Glenn." And it brought me out onto the stage, and he said, "I'm thinking about letting Miss Yor go. I will make my decision during this matinee performance. If I decide to let her go, I want you to go on tonight. Can you do it?" And I said, "Yes." But I had not had a rehearsal. He said, "Okay, so after the show, go up to your dressing room," which was like on the 4th floor of this little garret of a dressing room. "Wait, and if you hear that you're wanted down in costumes, that means that you'll go on that night." So I went up to my dressing room, shaking, and waited. All the other actors went off to dinner. And after a while, I heard, "Will Glenn Close please come down to the costume?" And the thing about that production was that everybody had one costume. And so I put on her costume, filled with her perfume, and her wig that was still, you know, sweaty. And the thing that's remarkable was that at half hour, there was a knock on my door, and I was handed a note. And I opened it, and it said, "It's a tradition in the English theater for one leading lady to welcome the next. I welcome you. Be brave and strong, Mary Yor."
It's an amazing story.
It's amazing. And in her pain, she had the grace to do that for me. It's astounding. She didn't say, "Break a leg," or "Knock him dead." She said, "Be brave and strong." Sure. And the next spring, she died.
Wow.
that the greatest lesson about the profession was that after that show was over, I went back up to my 4th story dressing room from the, you know, Stars dressing room, and finished out the run with little parts as an understudy.
Not only did you come from Connecticut, but your ancestors helped found Greenwich, Connecticut. Is that right? And you're 12th generation American, is that correct?
Yes.
And I read that you in your early childhood, you lived in a stone cottage on a farm, which seems very like the platonic ideal of Connecticut. I mean, was there a kind of society life that your family was part of, a kind of blue-blooded set?
My grandparents on both sides certainly were. My parents were very much black sheep. They didn't buy into all that. So in my early childhood, we lived on my grandfather Moore's farm, and we could have been in Iowa as far as we were concerned.
I see. Your parents also enrolled your whole family in this thing called the Moral Rearmament, which you've described as a cult-like group that kind of dictated how you lived and what you were supposed to feel. And you said, I'm treading very lightly on this subject because I know it's a difficult one, but you've said you were made to feel guilty about any unnatural desire. And there were these kind of...
Well, maybe I should say any natural desire.
Uh-huh. So my question is, you were in this organization, I think from ages 7 to 22. Was having to modify your behavior, was that helpful when you started to act, or was it something you had to overcome? I mean, sort of having all your instincts scrambled like that.
That's a lot to answer. I will say this, that the 7 years I had in the Connecticut countryside probably has sustained me more in my life than any other thing. What happened afterwards, I have very little memory of. I mean, I can try to reconstruct things, but you're totally pulled up from what your roots were and what you loved, and your family is, you know, pulled apart, and these things are imposed on you. And for a child with the kind of imagination that I had, I, of course, wanted to be the good soldier. And I think the group became my parent in a way. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very destructive.
Mm-hmm.
I think one good thing is that my parents always made sure we had a good education. Some kids would go and, you know, be tutored within the group. We never did that. And I think that was very, very good.
Hmm. So let's skip ahead to when you began your film career in 1982. We're going to watch a clip from your first film, The World According to Garp. You played Garp's mother. She's a kind of nurse slash feminist guru who doesn't believe in lust or something, and has very particular thoughts about intercourse and reproduction. And here she is explaining to young Garp and another guy how he was conceived. Let's take a look.
The war was on. I was a nurse. One day they brought in a tail gunner who had been wounded by anti-aircraft in a raid over Germany. A splinter of steel had lodged in his brain, and all he could say was his name, Garp. For medical reasons I couldn't quite understand, he also had a constant erection. Well, he deteriorated steadily. Till one day all he could say was part of his name, Arp. It was then that I knew that he wouldn't last much longer. His erections continued, however, quite unabated.
I see. I'll just
not yet. No. No, not yet. Oh. You'd better rest. Anyway, where was I?
He kept having erections.
I feel like that child actor learned a few things during that scene. So this is such an unusual, great, wacky movie. One thing that's so striking about it is that it's your first movie, you were 35, and you start the film as a young mother. You ended as a grandmother, and your son eventually is played by Robin Williams, who was 4 years younger than you. I mean, how did you approach something like that, on film no less, playing this kind of ageless character?
Well, we rehearsed. It was George Roy Hill, And he had started in live television. So what he did, and it was Robin Williams' second movie. You know, he was a huge star from Mork and Mindy, and then he had done Popeye, and this was his second film. And George, the company rented space up at Columbia, and they put down the tape on the floor as if we were rehearsing a play, and we rehearsed the movie. And then when the sets were ready, we moved to the old Astoria studio and rehearsed there with the cameraman. So that was something I understood, and I was able to, you know, get into the character. Her, yeah, so for me, it was really serendipitous to start that way. And I remember going up to George and saying, I hear it's a really, really difficult transition to go from stage to film. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I hope you'll take care of me. And he did.
So you followed this movie with a bunch of films like The Natural and The Big Chill, in roles that you've described as Earth Mothers. Was there a conscious decision somewhere in the mid-80s to like make a huge swerve into like femme fatales? Was it conscious? Was there
No, I was just lucky to get the part. I mean, they really didn't want me for Fatal Attraction. I mean, they didn't even want me to audition. And it was because of my agent that they actually begrudged me an audition, and that got me the part. But they were, I mean, it's hilarious to hear about that now.
Of course, because we can't think of a single other person playing the role of Alex Forrest. Let's take a look at a scene from Fatal Attraction. This is Alex confronting Michael Douglas's character, Dan, after their affair.
I want this child. It has nothing to do with you. I want it whether you're going to be a part of it or not.
Then why are you telling me, huh? Why? Why just go ahead and do it?
I was hoping that you would want to be a part of it.
This is crazy. This is totally insane.
I'm 36 years old. It may be my last chance to have a child.
Alex. Just think what you're saying. Just think about it. We are going to live with this for the rest of our lives.
I know that. I've thought of that. I know how you feel. It's a big thing. But it doesn't have to be a problem, really. It doesn't. You play fair with me, I'll play fair with you.
I've seen that in a long time.
No? Yeah. What is it like revisiting that movie that I'm sure so many people associate you with, still to this day?
Is that why I don't ever get any dates? Wow, I haven't seen that in a very long time. What was your question?
Well, so I wanted to ask you, I mean, this movie has recently been kind of back in consciousness, especially because of its 30th anniversary. And when it came out, it got this sort of feminist pushback and probably saved a lot of married men from making a really bad mistake. But, you know, it also kind of, it's possible to look back at it and see a kind of Reagan-era family values. You know, this is this suburban nuclear family that must be protected from the intruder, and people have interpreted it that way a lot. How do you view the politics of the movie?
I honestly didn't think about politics when I was making the film. My personal feeling now is that looking back, feminism happened, and I think that movie came at a certain time where it just touched on this incredibly raw nerve and became the phenomenon that it became. I was shocked by certain feminists were against it, saying that it gave single working women a bad name. My feeling was that I wasn't generally acting. I was acting somebody very specific, and that was her story. Also, there's a lot about that character that the audience doesn't know, that I had in my head and that I had done work with psychiatrists about. I mean, it's a famous story. The original ending was so upsetting, where Alex kills herself, because she's basically a self-destructive, suicidal personality. And the audience was so upset that they honestly didn't think she was punished enough. And they hated the ending, because he went off to jail. But she's considered one of the great villains of, you know, on film. And I find that highly ironic, you know, given the, you know, what I went through to.
Right.
Do that.
Well, I know in recent years you've been active in mental illness awareness. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. How did that start?
It started because my sister Jessie came to me one day and said, I need your help because I can't stop thinking about killing myself. And my mother and I were able to get her to a place that finally, at age 51, she was properly diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And I've learned so much. We started something called Bring Change to Mind, which fights against the stigma. Mm-hmm. And I think if all more families, as a family, could talk about it, I think it would be a different world.
We're going to watch a scene from, I think, the very next movie you did, Dangerous Liaisons. This is an incredible specimen of film acting. This is your character, the Marquise, explaining sort of how she moves through the world and why. So let's take a look at Dangerous Liaisons.
I practiced detachment. I learned how to look cheerful while under the table I stuck a fork into the back of my hand. I became a virtuoso of deceit. It wasn't pleasure I was after, it was knowledge. I consulted the strictest moralist to learn how to appear, philosophers to find out what to think, and novelists to see what I could get away with. And in the end, I distilled everything to one wonderfully simple principle. Win or die.
Woo. That looks hard. Was there a reason that you felt you went through a period where you were playing really scary people? Did you feel like there was something about you that you were able to scare people, specifically men?
No, it's that's fascinating. They just came along at a certain time. I mean, I'd done Fatal Attraction, and then Dangerous Liaisons came up. But I don't think of them as evil. The only evil character I think I've ever played was Cruella.
Thank you, Glenn, so much for being here.
It is rather amusing, isn't it?
What is?
Well, if we make this coat, it would be as if I were wearing your dog. Woof, woof!
Glenn Close speaking with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman in 2017. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. I'm David Remnick, and I want to thank you for joining us. Next time, I'll talk about the Russia investigation and many other matters with Mark Warner of Virginia, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Till then, stay in touch with us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Emily Mann, Cal Alia, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.